The fighter banked gently, evenly, but rapidly to port under her hands as she climbed it in preparation of another ascending sweep over her assigned section of the grid. Even with the best night vision equipment available, all Emma Shaw could see was the blackness of the ocean. And she still wasn't 100% firm in her mind as to what action she would take should she see the Admiral's helicopter. She listened attentively as the revised orders had come in over the new frequency she'd been instructed to tune to. These instructions relayed to her in person from the crew chief on the flight line just as she was prepared to close her canopy. It was hoped that the faked radio messages that would be sent out over the usual frequencies would delude the men aboard the stolen helicopter, but there was no reason to assume that they wouldn't be scanning a wide range of frequencies and pick up the Enclair transmissions despite the precautions. The new orders were based on a theory of John's, and the idea did make sense. If she had stolen the Admiral's helicopter, she would have done what John supposed the Nazis were doing. And because of her agreement with the new orders, she was doubly frustrated searching empty ocean. But orders were orders, and she usually obeyed them. She attained flight level and almost immediately contacted her wingman.
This is Lookout 5 to Lookout 5 Alpha and Bravo. I'm at altitude and about to begin next search sequence. Signal that you copy. Over.
Lookout 5 Alpha and Lookout 5 Bravo responded in turn. She queried them as to their positions. Alpha was finishing a search pattern, had picked up a blip of something on the horizon, and gone to investigate, but the blip turned out to be only a Russian freighter steaming toward the Orient. Bravo was nearly at altitude and would be commencing his next search pattern approximately a minute after Commander Emma Shaw began hers. She started into a dive, the chest holster which carried her Lancer 2570 A2C 9mm caseless pressed hard against her left breast by the G-force. Emma hoped that John Rourke was right, that instead of out here somewhere over the vast expanse of the Pacific, the Nazi commando team and their prize, Martin Zimmer, were someplace safe where they could be found by John Rourke. Kroenberg smiled as he sat on the end of a flat rock in order to tie his track shoes. A good officer learned to realize when it was wisest to discard even the best thought-out plan in the face of enormous opportunity. Such was now the case. He had planned to leave young Martin shackled, then order the men to execute him. But this idea was even better.
And so you see, Gruppenführer, this place is most unacceptable. We could all die here because this volcano might erupt.
Martin! Would your old friend let you be endangered? Of course not.
The Gruppenführer is right, Herr Zimmer. All of us, Herr Zimmer, are devoted to your safety even at the cost of our own lives.
Indeed.
The Gruppenführer could not have known about the volcano, Herr Zimmer. Is this not so, Herr Gruppenführer?
Indeed, Roth. But it is a happy circumstance, bringing confusion to our enemies and enabling us to hide here better while we await transportation. I am certain it is nothing to worry about.
And the volcanic activity was proving fortunate in another way that Kroenberg could never have imagined, but in which he now saw considerable advantage. This would cost him the lives of 5 loyal comrades, of course, but to have had these men survive with the guilty knowledge they would have possessed might have been too dangerous to suffer at any event. So they would have had to be killed at a future date. It was better to let them die now. He was reminded of the pharaonic method for keeping a secret. The ancient Egyptians would have slaves bury their treasure or their kings. The present occasion would be more similar to the burial of a king, and these slaves guarded by trusted priests. The priests would kill the slaves, then the tongues of the priests would be cut out to keep the secret forever. Kroenberg would especially miss Roth, and he toyed with the idea of sparing the young officer's life. But to take the field commander away might have looked suspicious to the other 4 men.
I think, my friend, that it is best for me to establish that the safe house to which we intend repairing is indeed safe. We cannot risk our Martins being recaptured. I had not anticipated the enormity of the search force arrayed against us. Would you agree that I should go on alone and send the plane back?
Kroenberg had wisely ordered that all frequencies be scanned, and as a result knew that Dr. Rourke had second-guessed their basic plan. But Kroenberg followed through with it anyway, based on information he had heard while setting the scanning monitor. That information was in the form of radio communications between the control tower at Pearl Harbor and the massive cargo planes which filled the skies above the base and flew from Oahu toward the island of Hawaii. There was an evacuation in progress because Kilauea was erupting.
Yes, Herr Gruppenführer. That does sound best, that the safe house should be investigated. But I would volunteer, Herr Gruppenführer, to undertake this mission personally.
Good man. But I shall go it alone, I think.
Gruppenführer?
Yes, Martin?
Is it safe to wait here? The volcano, I mean, the eruption?
These volcanoes in Hawaii are always doing this, Martin. You should read more, my young friend. You will be perfectly safe.
In fact, as the snippets of radio traffic had indicated, this volcanic cone was quite possibly the least safe place on the face of the Earth now. Kronberg glanced at his watch beneath the beam of the small flashlight from his pocket. In 2 minutes, if the pilot were prompt, he would board the vertical takeoff jet and be gone. And the death of young Martin and of Rolf and all the others would be a great tragedy rather than a murder, which would need to be hidden beneath more murders. As Rolvag donned the oxygen breather, he heard the thunder of jet engines from above. And as he looked, he saw a V-Stall cargo craft swooping in from the west out of the purple night. He spoke into his radio set as soon as the airflow was adjusted to his comfort.
This is Rolvag calling Navy 189 Charlie 18. This is Rolvag calling Navy 189 Charlie 18. Come in, Navy.
This is Navy Helicopter 189 Charlie 18, Dr. Rolvag. Reading you loud and clear, over.
Patch me in. Patch me in at once to Dr. Rourke. I have what he's looking for.
Rolvag watched as the V-Stall landed near the center of the crater. But only one man walked toward the aircraft, and it wasn't the one who looked like a somewhat weaker version of John Rourke himself. John Rourke stripped away the radio headphones. He stayed in the chair beside the console, staring at its buttons and dials and diodes.
Rolvag has spotted them. One of them left by jump jet, but the other six men, one of them Martin, stayed behind.
Where?
The volcano. The one... Oh, shit.
John Rourke smiled at his friend, then looked at the communications officer who stood near the door.
Ensign?
Yes, sir.
Ensign, I need your help.
Whatever the general would require, sir.
It's a favor, this radio message. I know you have it on tape and it's logged automatically on the computer. I want you to hold back on notifying base headquarters of the contents of this message for 15 minutes.
But, sir, I...
Ensign, this will be an easy favor.
And John Rourke reached under his jacket and drew one of the twin stainless Detonics 45s, not actually pointing the gun at her, but letting her see it.
Now, you can say I forced you to cooperate. Paul, I'm taking a helicopter and going in. You keep an eye on the ensign until 15 minutes have passed.
Another way, John. You're not going alone.
He's my son. I can't ask you...
I'm your friend. You can't stop me, even with one of those. But Michael's arm's still bothering him a little. And I don't think Annie and Natalia should come along.
All right. But Rolvag says the eruption is already starting. Could be hours or minutes before the top of that mountain blows. And he thinks that's only a prelude to an even larger eruption.
We better get started. And the ensign can accompany us to the airfield. Then she can walk back. That'd give us 15 minutes or more.
Sorry, ensign.
Thorn Rolvag could hardly see. The fumarole near where he had hidden to observe the men in the cone now spewed gas at such a furious pace that great clouds of the vile sulfurous mixture enveloped the mountaintop. But the interior of the cone, when he'd moved out, was still free of the gas. Instead, the winds still blowing the gas out toward the sea. Although he considered his work done, he'd reported to Dr. Rourke, returned the favor done to him, he would have been forced to evacuate the position at any event. No choice left to him unless he wished to be killed. The vents which lined the shield, like great glowing veins, had begun to spill forth magma. It was pahoehoe, fluid and fast-moving. And, even as he moved along the shield now, it was necessary at times to change from his intended path, as geysers of magma would spout before him, brightly flaming liquid rock soaring skyward, raining down and scorching the ground, flowing before him as if the mountainside itself were his enemy, trying to trap him in its killing ground. The oxygen mask was a blessing, because without it he would have been dead. A lava flow was moving downward along the shield, roughly from right to left in relation to Rovog's line of travel. He jumped it, only about 18 inches wide here, running now before he was truly cut off. He spoke into his radio again.
Navy, come in and get us. Come in and get us. I'm already on the way, Doc. Keep your radio open so I can home in on you. If you shoot off a flare, I'll never see it. Be ready, because I'm not anxious to wait. Now, Carl, do you have the pressure measurements?
There was no response.
Carl!
Rolvag, his breath coming so fast he was afraid he would hyperventilate in the oxygen mixture, scanned the shield below him for some sight of Carl Bremen. If the young man had gotten into trouble, gotten hurt, Rolvag knew he would never forgive himself. The ground only a few yards ahead of Rolvag split and the mountainside trembled. Rolvag fell. Magma rolled up with more force than Rovag would have imagined possible, spouting into the purple smoke already engulfing the mountainside and flowing like white water over rapids across the slabs of volcanic rock it dislodged, pushing them along with tremendous force, tearing loose every rock and boulder in its path.
Carl, I need you to answer me. The helicopter is coming in to get us, but I need you to answer me.
There was still no answer. As Rovag moved, he realized suddenly that he was lost, that the entire landscape had so violently and suddenly altered that there were no landmarks. And fear, cold and sickening and overpowering, seized him, and his breathing was so rapid now that he was becoming lightheaded.
Carl!
There was still no answer. Thorn Rovag stopped dead in his tracks. He forced his breathing to slow, spoke as calmly as he could into the radio microphone before his lips.
Navy, can you hear me? Reading you loud and clear, Doc. If you hold on to your current position, I'll find you. Keep talking me in. Then we can find Mr. Bremen together, over? That seems like a good idea. Glad you see it my way, Doc. Keep talking. What's your favorite baseball team, over? The Oahu Eagles. Huh, terrific pitcher, Oakton. If he could hit as well as he throws, he'd be the top man in the league. What you think about Stadler, over? Stadler's okay. My kids like Stadler because he's so young. Needs seasoning. I'm right over you, Doc. Look up and you should see me, over?
Rovag could hear no ambient sound except the explosions of rock surrounding him. It was a battlefield, and nature was the enemy. But as he looked up, he thought he saw the clouds of gas swirling in a regular pattern. Then there was a beam of light, bright but indirect, like something seen through a dirty window.
Do you have a searchlight on? That's us, Doc. We'll let you down a ladder. Don't try climbing out. Just secure yourself to it with your extraction harness. And we'll get you out of here. Get you down safe, and get you aboard, and we go after Bremen, okay? Over? Okay, yes. But hurry. Bremen must be in trouble. Affirmative that, Doc. But we'll find him. Hang in there. Over.
Rovag had no choice. They threw down the ladder, and Thorn quickly climbed into the jet. He leaned against the wall, it was called a bulkhead, he remembered, and watched hell unfold beneath him as a frighteningly vivid panorama of fire and ash and sulfurous fumes and molten rock reached up into the night toward them. And somewhere down there, Bremen was in trouble, if not already dead. Rovag, still sweating from fear and exhaustion, spoke into the radio.
Carl, find some way of signaling to us, please. You can hear me, I feel it. I know you can hear me. Find some way of making a signal.
But what could Carl Bremen do? A flare would go unseen, even the brightest flare. Rovag shouted forward to the crew of the Navy helicopter.
There must be some way. This is Mr. Bremen, Doc. He pretty sharp with electronics?
It was the pilot who called back to him, and Rovag got to his feet, unsteadier still because of the turbulence surrounding the helicopter. But he started forward. The pilot was a black man named Butler.
Assume he can hear us, but we can't hear him, right? Otherwise, we're really out of luck finding him. But what if we can talk him through changing his radio around so he can't receive, but he can see it? Well, then he can talk to us. He'll feel cut off, but we can find him. He's probably scared shitless by now, so you'll have to prep him for it. But if you figure he trusts you enough, maybe this'll work. Jim, get up and give the man a chair.
The co-pilot vacated his seat, and Rovag sank into it.
But I don't know if I could change a radio around. Maybe I could, but I don't know if I could talk him through it. I can. You start talking to him on your radio, then when you figure it's time, turn him over to me, Doc. It's his only chance. Carl, this is Thorn Rovag. I want you to listen to me very carefully, and I'm praying that you can listen to me. We're losing oil pressure in the main rotor. Strap in, Doc. We're going down. Jim, get a Mayday out without position.
Great plumes of smoke and ash, alive with particles of molten rock, flared thousands of feet upward into the night, illuminating the volcano's shield and almost the entire southern portion of the island of Hawaii. Below Rourke and Rubenstein, now the wreckage of the Navy helicopter, whose transmissions they had heard, a Mayday signal, was lit by the spewing volcanic vents surrounding it. It was a question of immediacy. Paul landed the helicopter as near to the crash site as possible in the event there were serious injuries, but it was necessary as well to keep two other considerations in mind. First, that the landing site was safe for the moment from the effects of the eruption, and second, that the actual landing could not be observed from within the cone, where Thorn Rovag had indicated that Martin and the others were located. There was nothing to guarantee, of course, that they were still there. Indeed, remaining was folly. But Rourke had to check, could not run the risk of losing Martin. But to have allowed Ensign Clyde to alert the base to the fact that Martin had been located would have precipitated even greater difficulties. If the Navy located Martin and the commando unit, there was always the possibility that Martin would be killed. And if the base were alerted, there would be no preventing Michael, Natalia, and Annie from coming to the scene. By now, of course, Ensign Clyde would have reported the message and what subsequently happened. The base would have scrambled helicopters to come after them, and doubtless Michael, Natalia, and Annie would be along. Rourke made it that they had their 15-minute head start and nothing more, and the few minutes' time they had been on the ground was canceled out by the amount of time it would have taken Pearl Harbor to scramble choppers to go after them. The HK-91 slung from his shoulder, its pistol grip in his right hand, the scoremaster's thrust into the waistband of his trousers, John Rourke kept to the right side of the rocky defile they paralleled. Paul Rubinstein, his German MP-40 submachine gun in his right fist, walked on the left. Their weapons, aside from Rourke's twin stainless Detonics combat masters worn in the old double Alessi rig under his battered brown leather bomber jacket, and the little A.G. Russell Sting 1A black chrome, Rourke always carried the two Detonics miniguns and Sting 1A, and Paul's Browning High Power, had been stowed in the trunk of the FOUO car Rourke had driven. Rourke's full-sized scoremasters, his 2-inch-barreled Smith & Wesson Centennial, and his Crane Life Support System 10 knife, and Paul's second high power and the old Gerber MK2 fighting knife, weapons that had helped Rourke and his friend survive as long as they had them coupled with the intelligence to use them properly, were too much to carry in this new civilized world. Here, on the face of Kilauea, there was no civilization, only the struggle to survive. When the Mayday signal had come from the crashing helicopter carrying Rovag, neither Rourke nor Rubinstein had questioned the necessity of what had to be done first. There was the immediate risk of lives at stake. Martin would have to wait. Using a portable direction finder from the rescue helicopter's equipment stores, set to the open frequency signal of the downed chopper, John Rourke guided them ahead, homing in. And just ahead, in the flare from a rupturing vent, Rourke saw the machine. The pilot was good at his work, John Rourke reflected.
Over there, about 200 yards, almost obscured by that rock uplift. See it?
I see it. Looks like a cabin area is intact. From what I can see, the rest of it looks like the tail section sheared away and the...
Rourke followed with his eyes in the direction where his friend gestured. Two of the enormous blades from the helicopter's main rotor had furrowed themselves into the rock, almost forming the shape of a cross, molten rock surging up around them.
Let's see if they're alive.
Veins in the face of the rock were opening with alarming rapidity, sections of the shield higher up along the cone starting to float away on the magma beneath, huge slabs of the blackened rock periodically slipping downward, stalling, lava building up behind them. So far, none had dislodged completely. When one did, any person in its way would be dead. The rock itself might weigh tons, and the lava behind it would turn flesh to ash. Traversing the shield now, it was necessary as they moved toward the downed helicopter to constantly alter their course because of freshly opening veins of magma. The rising gas from fumaroles higher up on the face of the mountain was becoming thicker, and the volcanic ash covered their clothing, anything exposed. The gas masks they wore were of the type incorporating integral hoods, and Rourke was for once grateful for the design, which he usually found a nuisance. His coat protected his weapons, except for the LS-10 knife and the HK-91. The knife would not be affected by the falling ash, and the HK was as rugged a firearm as ever made, either in its semi-automatic sporter form as Rourke carried it, or as a selective fire battle rifle. There were belches of flame from some of the wider veins in the rock, spouts of lava shooting upward. The volume of ash increased to the consistency of a sudden downpour, and there was a terrific roar which apprehended Rourke's attention, making him turn to face the summit. Ash spewed from very near the cone now, and lava was flowing in a river of molten rock several yards wide, perhaps 100 yards back, huge slabs of rock floating in it, battering out a channel. Rourke and Rubinstein, side by side, clambered over a dislodged slab of volcanic rock. Beyond it lay the partially destroyed Navy helicopter. There were emergency lights lit within. But they might already be too late to survive. More than 15 minutes had passed, and with the pace of the eruption moving at such a frenetic pace, they might not make it off the mountain alive, let alone get Martin. They kept going. Where was Gruppenführer Kroenberg? Martin Zimmer, his hands shaking and the pit of his stomach freezing cold, grabbed Roth by the shoulder and spun him around.
We will all be killed here, Roth. You have to do something, now!
The Gruppenführer may be having a difficult time getting in because of the eruption, Herr Zimmer, but I am certain...
Fool! You must do something now! I will be killed here! The volcano is erupting, man! Are you blind? Get me to safety!
Herr Zimmer, we are all stranded here until Herr Gruppenführer returns. Where can we go?
Lava was spewing out of spreading ruptures in the living rock, pouring down and away from them. But the rock beneath Martin Zimmer's feet seemed to shake more violently by the second. How soon before the interior of the volcanic cone would crack and the lava would consume them all in flame.
What if the Gruppenführer isn't coming back?
Not come back, Herr Zimmer? What are you saying? The Gruppenführer would not abandon us, his men, or certainly you, the son of Dietrich Zimmer, the leader. Never. He has been delayed. That is all, I am certain. At any moment, the aircraft will return, and we will be taken from this hell. Do not be afraid.
Afraid? You dare say that I am afraid?
Martin Zimmer turned away, walked off, trying to control his breathing, trying to control the trembling of his entire body. If Kronberg had left them here to die, there was nothing that they could do. And Martin Zimmer not only did not want to die, but the world could not be denied his leadership. John's hands worked furiously over the pilot, closing up the sucking chest wound over the man's left lung. A small blade from the tail rotor had sheared away, cut through the gap where the tail section had been, penetrated the pilot from back to front, and buried itself in the control panel. The other crewman was dead, his neck broken. Paul Rubenstein worked over Thorn Rolvag, who was unconscious when he and John found the downed helicopter. He was now just coming around.
Bremen, we gotta find Carl.
Carl? Bremen, take it easy.
He's out there somewhere, down.
Paul Rubenstein's mind raced. Assuming that Rolvag knew what he was talking about, this Carl Bremen, perhaps the graduate student who had accompanied Rolvag in the taking of his pressure measurements, would have to be below where they had landed their helicopter. Otherwise, he and John would have seen the man.
Look, I think I can find him. Lie still, all right?
Butler.
John's helping him. The other man's dead.
Jesus.
Whatever. You just take it easy. If you feel it'll help, pray for your friend. I think we can find him.
John had cursorily examined Rolvag after putting a hasty compression bandage to the pilot's wound, pronounced Rolvag seemingly okay. There was no way to tell about any possible concussion. As Paul Rubenstein looked around in order to confer with John, John was not looking at him. John's face in the yellow light of the emergency overhead lamp seemed more a mask of determination than anything human.
I heard what you said. You and Rolvag should be able to get the pilot here down to our aircraft. Then lead them there and look for this man Bremen. Give yourself a time limit. Then, one way or the other, get airborne. If you can do it safely, come over the cone and look for me and for Martin.
John!
Let me finish. We're out of time. You know that as well as I do. The whole side of the mountain could blow away at any second. We don't have any more than 20 minutes or so of oxygen left. And once we go to breathing regular air, we've got maybe a few more minutes before the gas puts us under. The only thing we can do is this. Now you take care of these men and I'll go after Martin.
But
it's not just for Sarah, Paul. Martin's still my son.
Paul Rubenstein didn't try to argue. He would have done the same himself had Martin been his and Annie's son. Any professional military person, perhaps only after one too many drinks, would admit that there were times when orders had to be ignored. But Emma Shaw had never so obviously gone against orders in all of her life. But there wasn't any choice. The radio traffic told the story, and it was a story she could not accept. John and his friend Paul Rubenstein were trapped on Kilauea, and the helicopter they had stolen was their only out. A helicopter would have as much chance of making it through the storm of lava, ash, and gas as a snowball in hell. And it was hell where John and Paul Rubenstein were. But if she could reach the volcano in time, unless the whole thing were blown sky high by then, which according to the radio traffic could take place at any second, she could get her V-Stall fighter bomber in there. It would be a tough jump if she had a lot of people to pack in the bomb bay, but she'd taken off out of tight spots with a full load of blockbuster bombs, and they weighed more. She could do it. In her mind's eye, she was picturing how the people would have to pack in along the fuselage in order not only just to fit, but to keep from being thrown about against the bulkheads once the aircraft accelerated out of the vertical mode. There might be some bumps and bruises, but she could make it, in and out. Or try, at least. Emma Shaw signaled her wingmen.
I'm going to Kilauea. Return to base. Shaw out.
And she banked the tip of her port side wing and broke formation. 13 minutes of air remaining, according to the diode counter. Two 20-round magazines for the HK-91 clipped together. Whole sections of the mountainside floating off in rivers of lava. John Thomas Rourke reached the crest of the summit, and from the top of the shield looked down into the crater. He was reminded, oddly, of an ice floe. Except for the difference in materials, the plain at the interior of the cone was like that. Whole sections of it broken off, riding on the lake of magma beneath, the volcanic veins brilliantly illumined in flame, like the veins of the human body, but distended and discolored and ready to burst. Paul should be back at the helicopter by now, or nearly so. Hopefully Paul would listen to him, give only a reasonable amount of time to find this fellow Bremen, then give it up and get airborne. Hopefully, but not likely. Paul would no more leave a man out here to die than John Rourke would. So if he couldn't find the man, Paul was as likely doomed as Rourke himself felt. Logic dictated that once he set foot into the cone, aside from Martin and the other five men there, all heavily armed Nazi commandos, the magma would at least trap him, at worst explode around him. There was no choice. John Rourke began to climb over into the interior of the cone, picking his way to avoid the luminous coals and the growing fissures. The plain within the cone was like a valley, broad from end to end, narrow from side to side, like another valley often spoken of, the Valley of Death. Paul left Rolvag, the scientist a little fuzzy-headed from his injuries, it seemed, but eager to do whatever could be done, with the injured pilot safe inside the helicopter, as safe as one could be on the slope of an erupting volcano. And Paul Rubinstein told himself that somehow, if he were unable to find this man Carl Bremen, or unable for some other reason to return, that Rolvag and the pilot, seriously but not mortally wounded, still able to talk, to hear, would in one way or another get the helicopter airborne. John had known the real way of it when he'd said what he said. John wouldn't have left this Bremen, the graduate student, here on the mountain, and neither would Paul Rubinstein. And Paul Rubinstein had often wondered if women lied to each other as often as men did. John knew. Paul knew. Paul went on his way, searching on the slope below for the hapless graduate student, Carl Bremen. John would be at the cone by now, perhaps already moving into it. The mountain shook so violently that Paul Rubinstein could hardly keep his footing. John knew that the eruption would be complete in a matter of minutes, perhaps, and they would all die. Paul Rubinstein knew it, too. Perhaps the entire Earth trembled. It felt as if that were true as the first shockwave came. John Rourke fell to his knees, making the third leg of a tripod with the butt of the Heckler & Koch rifle, keeping himself from falling prone by strength and force at will as the mountain heaved and the very floor of the plain here within the cone rose and sank. Lava flowed from the enormous wound in the living rock like suppurating pus. Lava geysering skyward with such intensity that in the next instant the very darkness rained fire. The six men, Martin one of them, who had taken refuge within a natural rock fortress at the very center of the cone, had not yet seen him. Rourke imagined them rather preoccupied with their own survival at the moment. The sea of magma rolled beneath them, and waves of the liquid rock upthrust and crashed and lashed out in fiery fury. The very rock on which the fortress was set floating like a raft on the tempest-tossed fire. There was still a bridge leading out to the fortress, and John Rourke, as he descended the volcanic shield, started toward it. They had not seen him, but if he were spotted, he would be without shelter from their fire. He thought of Paul, praying that his friend would get the helicopter up and out of the ever-expanding inferno. Fumaroles were everywhere, great spouts of noxious gas and acrid charcoal-colored smoke belching skyward on all sides of him, an enormous cloud hanging low over the interior of the cone, its grayness alleviated only by the falling pieces of yellow hot rock. The interior of the cloud glowed orange and purple. Ash rained everywhere, forcing Rourke to smudge it away from his mask's protective eye covering every few seconds just so that he could see. The action of the HK-91 was covered with it. Rourke, running as best he could, still keeping his balance, neared the bridge leading out to the island of rock on which the fortress floated. As John Rourke stepped onto the bridge, the mountain roared its anger again and the bridge twisted, angled to Rourke's left. But Rourke kept his balance. The bridge was narrowed now. The volume of magma suddenly increased. The fiery liquid rock splashed within inches of his combat-booted feet. Should a wave of the lava lap over his feet, what little protection the leather afforded would be vaporized in a microsecond, and so would his flesh beneath. Rourke kept moving. In the same instant that he smudged away more of the ash from the lenses of his mask, gunfire tore into the rock beside Rourke's feet, energy bursts crackling through the air near his head. Rourke brought the HK-91 to his shoulder. A man in seaman's clothes fell through a niche in the rock. John Rourke quickened his pace, his only hope now to get into the fortress and fight it out at close range. Stranded here, he would not only be visible and easy to pick off, but was also prey to the rapidly diminishing width of the bridge of rock along which he trod. Rourke ran forward across the bridge. Another energy weapon was fired toward him, blue-white bolts of plasma flickering through the maelstrom of molten rock and burning ash. Another energy bolt, then another. The bolts intercepted the rain of debris, making the bits of rock explode like shrapnel around him. Rourke's body was pummeled with the rock, bits of it clinging to the old leather jacket he wore, burning like phosphorus. Rourke swatted at a piece with his gloved left hand, and the leather of the glove smoked. Rourke kept running. He was near the island of rock now, the mountain shaking so violently that most of his concentration was consumed with keeping his balance. One of the Nazis rose up from behind the fortress wall some 10 feet above and fired almost point blank. Rook was already moving, throwing himself forward, flush against the rocky surface of the fortress wall. The Nazi who had fired at him was above him now, bringing his energy weapon to bear in line with John Rourke's head. The head of the Nazi who stood over him exploded, and the body fell back and away, out of sight. John Rourke let go of his rifle, grasping instead for additional purchase on the rock as the fingers of his left hand began to slip. Rourke swung there. Two of the men with Martin were gone. That left three more, and Martin Zimmer himself. Bremen seemed more dead than alive as Paul Rubinstein at last slung the young man over his right shoulder in a fireman's carry. But there was breathing, a pulse, and a heartbeat. A slab of rock, massive seeming from the swatch it had cut in the rocks around it, had evidently dislodged and crashed down near Rolvag's graduate student, breaking up, huge chunks of it surrounding Carl Bremen. There was a wound to Bremen's head, bleeding heavily. But Paul Rubinstein remembered John's often stating that head wounds were deceptive and frequently showed a great deal of blood in disparate proportion to their size. Paul had cleared away some of the rocks after applying a makeshift bandage to the head wound. Then, after determining as best he could that neither Bremen's neck nor back seemed broken, he moved the man, hauled him awkwardly into a standing position, then bent into him for the carry. As Paul trudged back along the slope, changing direction every few steps to avoid trickles and larger flows of magma, he realized that the helicopter might well be gone. If Rolvag had any sense and could get the pilot's help, it would be. But as Paul Rubinstein reached the summit of a rock upthrust, he saw it below. His heart sank. Rolvag and the pilot were outside, some 50 feet back from it. The starboard side of the helicopter half vanished into an open crack in the surface of the slope. Magma spewing up from the crack, the machine itself on fire. There was no escape from the mountain's eruption now, but he would try. They were doomed. John Rourke edged along the fortress wall, at any moment expecting the waves of boiling magma to crash upward and cover him, or expecting another of the three remaining Nazis, or perhaps even Martin himself, to fire down at him. Rourke reached a split in the wall. He looked up. The fortress rose some 15 feet here, the rock slick and gray, but the crack, a foot or so at best, perhaps wide enough that he could use his hands to pull and his feet like wedges. The HK rifle slamming against his side, Rourke started up. The Navy helicopter pilot, Butler, could walk with a little help from Thorn Rolvag. There was nothing to do with Carl Bremen but carry him. Since Paul already had the man, he told Rolvag he would keep him across his shoulder as long as he could, then give Rolvag a turn. Oxygen in their breathing units was at varying levels. Rolvag's, not a jury-rigged thing like the one Paul Rubinstein wore, having almost 30 minutes remaining. Paul gauged his own supply at 5. Both the injured Bremen and the Navy pilot, Butler, wore units like the one worn by Rolvag. Paul, as he walked in a long-strided commando walk down the face of the slope, was already working on what he would tell Rolvag. And although Paul Rubinstein detested the very idea of a lie, under the circumstances it would be best.
I have a second oxygen tank back up the slope. You three go on. I'll look for the tank.
Or could he fake a sprained or broken ankle? No matter what, he would use the last of his oxygen going back for John. He couldn't just leave him. And if he, Rubinstein, was going to die, as seemed now inevitable, he would rather die with his friend.
Rolvag, listen. Your turn on Bremen. Then take him, and you and Butler go on. I'm going back for another oxygen tank. Otherwise, I'm already dead. Just keep going. I'll catch up.
And Paul Rubinstein shifted Bremen down, helped Rolvag in getting the man onto his shoulder. Then Paul Rubinstein started back up the slope, toward the fire-brimming cone of the volcano, to find John Rourke. He kept to a metered pace, because if he moved too rapidly, the oxygen would burn up all the faster. John Rourke lay wedged within the crack of the rock fortress walls, catching his breath. That was becoming progressively more difficult, the supply of his air tank down almost to empty. He could survive a while longer at reduced efficiency once the tank was fully depleted, and he imagined the burning lungs and aching heads of the men within the fortress, his enemies, all mere human beings. Perhaps, but the helicopter should be gone. Paul would see his obligation to Rolvag and Butler and this fellow Bremen, if Paul was able to find him, see his obligation to get them to safety. No win. John Rourke pushed himself up out of the wedge. Waves of magma lapped at the fortress walls, the islands on which the fortress floated lurching madly as Rourke clambered to the top of the fortress wall. Inside, in the flaring of the erupting lava, Rourke could see two of the men, prone, inert, lifeless seeming. Another crawled across the surface of the rock floor. The last clutched an energy rifle. This last man looked up and started to raise his weapon, but the effect of the air quality slowed him, Rourke realized. Rourke jumped. His body impacted man and rifle simultaneously, driving the rifle skittering away over the rocks, driving the man down. It was adrenaline rush taking over because the man wriggled from beneath him as Rourke caught his wind. The oxygen bottle was empty. Rourke struggled to his feet. The man braced him, a knife in each hand. Rourke stripped away the mask.
Die with honor if you dare.
All right.
Rourke's blade locked against one of the two knives, Rourke sidestepping, attempting to kick the man's right knee.
Ralph, look out for the bastard!
It was Martin who shouted the words. John Rourke reeled from them as the man with two knives, Rolf, Martin had called him, spun away. Tears welled up in John Rourke's eyes from the burning irritation of the gas, he told himself, but also, perhaps, because of Martin. This was his son, his enemy. Rolf dove forward, fainting with the knife in his right hand, the knife in his left, poised to piston forward. It was a professional knife fighter's move, but Rourke had seen it before. He dodged right, sidestepping the knife in Rolf's right hand, while Rourke's own blade hacked outward to intercept Rolf's left arm. Steel met flesh, and Rolf screamed, the knife falling from Rolf's suddenly limp fingers. Rourke's knife had sliced to the bone of the forearm, laying the flap of flesh and the clothing above it back. Rourke held the Crane LS-10 in a saber hold, thrusting it forward into Rolf's throat just below the Adam's apple. Rourke saw Martin, his son. Martin held an energy rifle.
You motherfucker!
Martin fired so indiscriminately that he took out his two remaining men. John Rourke dodged, turned back, and jumped toward the center of the rock enclosure, reaching for Rolf's lost energy rifle. Rourke grabbed it at the muzzle and hurled it toward Martin. The weapon struck Martin at the neck and right shoulder. Martin collapsed to his knees. Rourke was already up, the butt of his HK-91 slamming against Martin's right forearm, knocking the energy rifle aside.
Look!
John Rourke didn't turn his eyes.
Look! We're saved!
Above him, there was a roar, distinct from the roaring of the volcano, when John Rourke grabbed Martin Zimmer Rourke by the front of his shirt and dragged him to a standing position as he cast his eyes upward. Coming down out of the clouds of gas and ash and fire was a V-Stahl fighter bomber. The craft descended on twin pillars of fire like a deus ex machina of Greek tragedy, a machine of the gods as the means of divine intervention to save them. But the rock fortress surrounded by lava was too small an area for any craft to land in. As if the pilot, whoever he was, had read Rourke's thoughts, as the aircraft stabilized some 60 feet or so above them, a cable snaked downward, coils of it falling fewer than 10 yards from them.
We can get out! We can save ourselves!
Watch out for the prop washers. They could be deadly. Now go on, hook the cable around you. The pilot can winch it up.
Rourke shoved Martin ahead. Where the jet struck, fragments of rock were beaten up into cyclonic funnels. Rourke lurched after his son for a few feet and stopped. He turned, ran back to where the two unconscious Nazis lay. By rights, they were dead after Martin had fired so indiscriminately as he sprayed the interior of the rock fortress, but if they were not, Nazis or no, Rourke could not leave men to die here. His rifle safed and pushed away behind his back, Rourke found the first of the two. The man was dead. The second man, his face shot away. Rourke peered upward, the V-Stahl still above. And as Rourke threaded his way between the prop washes of the downwardly firing jets, the cable snaked downward again. Rourke caught up its end, falling to his knees as he did so. There was a hook on the end of the cable. Rourke wound a length of the cable around his body beneath his buttocks, hooking on. He jerked at the cable, but there was no way to tell if the pilot or winch operator, if there was a two-man crew aboard, could see him. But the cable began slowly to move. Rourke dragged himself to his feet, feeding out cable through his still-gloved hands. The cable was nearly taut. There was an instant of weightlessness, his feet off the ground, a sickening pendulum motion carrying him dangerously near the prop wash from the portside engine. Then he was rising. The ash was thicker here, and Rourke held his breath against it as he passed through a denser portion of the cloud. The V-Stahl pilot had to be insane coming here, fouling his engines. At any second, one or both could cut out, and at this altitude, in the vertical mode, either scenario would bring the aircraft crashing down. Rourke could see the opening above him. When he looked below, lava was just starting to overflow into the fort. And there was Martin, reaching down to him. Perhaps there was a spark of feeling in the boy.
I'm all right, son.
Martin's hand reached out to him. John Rourke took it. Martin was pulling him up over the lip of the fuselage door to safety.
Son.
But then he looked past Martin's face. Emma Shaw stood beside Martin, a .45 automatic in her right hand, the pistol aimed at Martin's head.
Son, I fuck you!
Emma holstered the pistol at her right thigh. There was a second pistol in a chest holster over her left breast.
We gotta get out of here, John. Watch him. We're on computer.
Rourke looked at his son.
You all right?
They're going to kill me.
Kill that bitch and fly out of here and I'll give you anything you want. anything. You like her? I'll give you a dozen better than her. And when you're done with that...
I want Dietrich Zimmer to operate to save your mother, Martin. To get the bullet out. To restore her to us.
Fine. Fine. Anything. Now kill the bitch.
Paul might still be down there. And Dr. Rolvag and the others. And I won't kill Emma Shaw. But if you get Dietrich Zimmer to save your mother's life, there's your chance. You're my son. I thought I'd have to kill you someday, but I can't. I won't let anyone hurt you. God help me. You're your mother's and my flesh and blood, son.
The aircraft was already in motion, rising.
Emma! Paul's down there! Some others! We got
them! I'll sweep for them until we find them, one way or the other, John. Come forward if you can.
Rourke dragged himself to his feet. Without bombs, stripped of most of what consumed space, the fighter bomber's aft section was roomy enough so that Paul and the others would fit in. And the aircraft had ample power, Rourke knew. He lurched forward, holding onto the co-pilot's seat, unslinging his rifle, slumping into the seat beside her.
You all right, John?
You're a brave woman. Thank you for saving my son.
Below them, the entire interior of the cone was almost consumed. Emma Shaw wore no helmet, no mask. He watched now as her tongue darted out, licked her lips.
John, if I hadn't kept a gun at his head, he would never have helped you.
He's still my son. Nothing can change that. I finally realized that.
Rourke peered through the canopy glass, his eyes scanning the slope. The Vistal flew perhaps 100 feet over the surface, terrain following. And John Rourke thought he saw something lying prone beside a lava fissure.
Can you land there? Maybe like you did over the cone?
I can't land. But you can rope down on the cable if you're up to it. Or just keep an eye on the computer controls, and Martin and I'll...
No, I'll do it.
Rourke dragged himself out of the seat. Emma tugged at his sleeve, offering him an oxygen mask.
Here, but slow.
Rourke's hands held to the grab straps as he stood there, the aircraft descending.
What the hell are we doing?
My friend is down there. Other people, too.
We could get killed. I'd give you...
Shut up, Martin!
Rourke looked to the winched cable above him and near the door. The controls seemed simple enough.
Okay, Martin. You let this down, help Commander Shaw. Then we'll all get out of here. Now do it!
Martin came to his feet. Rourke let out some of the cable, and as he looked below, he could see movement. It was Paul, had to be Paul, waving up at him. Rourke closed the cable around him, fed out more of it. Emma joined them.
I've got it, John. Hurry, but be careful. My air intakes are nearly 30% clogged. Once we're over 41%, we could lose an engine at any second.
I'm on my way.
Rourke jumped out into open space. He descended toward the slope, trying to control his breathing to minimize the intake of dust and ash. New vents were opening along the slope everywhere he looked, broad rivers of lava streaming downward across the slope and toward the sea far beyond, ribbons of flaming light in the darkness. As Rourke neared the ground, he could see Paul with greater clarity, his friend's right trouser leg cut away up the seam. The submachine gun Paul had always called a Schmeisser lashed to the outside of Paul's leg, probably with its sling. Rourke's feet touched the ground and he unhooked, released the cable, moved as rapidly as he could across the broken ground toward his friend, dropping to one knee beside Paul. Paul clasped his hand.
Martin!
Alive!
Lost my balance during one of the quakes. My foot caught in a crack. Think I broke my knee, or pulled it badly. I was just getting started again. You all right? What about Martin's pals?
He's all right. They're dead. Two by his hand. Where are the others?
You don't have them yet? They were on the way down the slope.
We'll get them next. Can you walk if I help?
Yeah. My lungs may never be the same, though.
You getting heavy?
No, just old.
They reached the cable, Rourke helping his friend to get the cable around him and hook it. Then Paul gave the cable a jerk and it started up, Rourke slumping down to his knees, waiting. And he looked toward the summit, but the cone was no longer there. A vast column of ash and dust obscured it, and the glow from within it was the lava, belching upward, destroying the old cone and building a fresh one. Rourke looked back to the V-stall. The cable was winding down toward him again. He reached for it, encircled himself with it, and gave a tug as he hooked on. Immediately, he was starting upward. He concentrated his gaze toward the downslope, searching for any sign of Rolvag and the others. Nothing. When he reached the height of the V-stall, Paul had a gun on Martin, Emma reaching out for Rourke. Rourke took her hand and arm and swung inward.
I'm all right.
Paul's going to ride up front. He'll know where to look.
Good idea. What happened to the helicopter?
While I was out looking for Rolvag's graduate student, Bremen, a vent opened up under it and the chopper slipped forward into the lava.
And you came back for me.
Rourke stared at Martin. The aircraft began to ascend.
You see what I mean, son? Like when you said I should just save you and me and kill Emma and leave the others? People don't do that to one another.
Where the hell have you been? People fuck each other every day, Dad. Shit. You go live on your damn mountaintop with the gods and do all this noble crap. We don't need anachronistic fools like you anymore.
You don't understand.
Honorable people keep their promises, can rely on one another. Friendship is a bond, just like love, joining people in a way that circumstances can't pull apart. A friend, a child, a wife, that's forever, Martin. Can't you see that? You can learn to. It's not your fault.
You want me to be the same damn good guy you always were? For what? Where's your wealth? Where's your power? You're into all this emotional shit. Where's your happiness? Faithful to some bitch lying in a damn coma and...
She's your mother, boy. Don't talk that way. Don't you ever talk.
Might makes right. There we agree.
John Rourke turned away.
I see him, John!
I can land there. There's a flat enough spot. I can make it vertical.
Thank God.
God? You actually believe in God? You're a fool. Think God's so all-powerful? Then why didn't he stop my real father who raised me from shooting your wife, huh? Why didn't he keep this frickin' volcano from erupting, huh?
I don't know the answers to questions like that, Martin. No man does. All we can do is try. Try to do the best that we can.
Why? For points with God when you die? Be real!
No, not for points with God, no. You do what's right because it's what's right. Everything doesn't have to profit you something, Martin. God or not, and I believe in God. But even if there wasn't God, or hell, or heaven, what would that do to change how a man or a woman should be? What's right is right. Nothing changes that. We do what's right and honorable because that's what it means to be a human being.
Martin looked away. Rourke felt sick to his stomach. The aircraft was landing vertically.
Touchdown!
The fuselage door opened. In the second after, there was a shudder of contact.
I'll watch Martin.
Right.
Emma was already walking aft. She jumped down from the opening in the fuselage, Rourke behind her. Rolvag, the pilot, and the third man, who had to be Bremen, were coming toward them. The pilot leaning on Rolvag, the third man walking, falling, getting up.
You help Dr. Rolvag with the pilot!
Lava flows were moving inexorably down the slope, the flows blending into one another as new vents opened, rivers of enormous width flowing downward. The gas here was less thick, and comparatively little ash fell. Rourke reached Bremen, letting the man collapse into his arms. Rourke slung Bremen over his shoulder. He looked back toward the V-stall. Emma was helping Rolvag get the pilot aboard. Rourke walked as rapidly as he could. With the added weight of Bremen on his shoulder, running was out of the question, given the state of his lungs and the air quality. The ground shook. As Rourke looked back, another fissure had opened, wide, blowing lava in an enormous upjetting plume into the purple and orange blackness above. Rourke reached the V-stall, Emma Shaw and Rolvag reaching out to take Bremen. Rourke handed Bremen up, then clambered in after him.
I'm getting us out of here.
Right.
Already, Rourke was to his knees beside Bremen.
This could be a rough takeoff. We've got a lava flow bearing down on us.
Everybody brace yourselves. Martin, get me the oxygen out of the survival kit on the bulkhead there.
As Rourke looked back at Bremen, the head injury didn't appear too severe and Bremen was breathing, he suddenly realized what he'd done. Rourke started to his feet, but Martin already had the survival kit open. There was an energy pistol in it.
You fire that in here and...
Martin leveled the energy pistol toward John Rourke's head. Rourke dove toward his son, shoving Rolvag and the injured pilot Butler out of the way. The aircraft was into vertical takeoff mode. There was no stopping now without crashing. Rourke's left hand closed over the pistol. Martin's right knee smashed upward into John Rourke's testicles. John Rourke flew back against the bulkhead beside the fuselage door. Martin Zimmer Rourke's left hand punched outward, not to Rourke's face, but toward the localized door control. The V-stall went into horizontal flight, and Rourke was thrown back. Martin was on top of him, beating his head with the energy pistol. Rourke's left elbow smashed upward into Martin's chest. Rolvag jumped onto Martin's back. Martin twisted around, the energy pistol firing, blasting a hole twice the size of a basketball in the fuselage opposite the door.
Stop it!
Fuel slipstreamed through the open fuselage door, and the hole opposite it tore at Rourke's exposed flesh. Martin was up, leveling the pistol toward the cockpit.
If I'm going to die, you're all going to die, damn you!
John Rourke reached up for his knees. Martin kicked at him. Rourke grabbed for Martin's foot, caught it, and twisted. Martin sprawled back against the bulkhead, swinging the muzzle of the pistol once again toward the cockpit, as Rourke, to his feet now, reached for his son.
And damn you, father!
The aircraft lurched. The energy pistol blew a hole in the overhead. John Rourke's left fist snaked upward toward Martin's jaw. The aircraft shuddered, twisted violently in midair, and started into a dive. Rourke's hand closed over Martin's wrist. Martin slipped backward.
Son! Son!
Martin's wrist slipped through John Rourke's fingers. Their eyes met. Hatred. Martin's body fell away, sucked out into the slipstream. John Rourke lurched after him. The airplane was into a dive now. Rourke's hands reached out into the slipstream after his son. The ground, crisscrossed in veins of golden light from the lava, was reaching up to take them. Hands were on Rourke's shoulders, dragging him back inside. Rourke sprawled against the starboard fuselage bulkhead, Rolvag and Butler, the Navy pilot, grabbing at him, holding him.
You'll be killed!
I have it under control!
The aircraft leveled off as Rourke and the two men flanking him slammed hard against the bulkhead.
John, you all right?
John Rourke stared out into the purple darkness where his son had gone. Rourke never said to Martin, I love you. Now he never could.
It wasn't your fault.
I've got radio contact with a helicopter that'll follow us back to Pearl in case we have to ditch. Major Tia Morovna's flying it. Your son and daughter are aboard too, John. It'll all be all right now.
Son. John Rourke's eyes filled with tears. He made the sign of the cross.
God forgive me. I killed my own son.
Survivalist Call to Battle is a Graphic Audio production. Copyright 1992, Jerry Ahern. Published by arrangement with Jerry and Sharon Ahern. All rights reserved. Production copyright 2010, The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved. Performed by Terrence Aselford, Eric Messner, Nanette Savard, Michael Glenn, Ken Jackson, MJ Casey, Dylan Lynch, Laura Quinn Anderson, Yasmin Toison, Tony Nam, MB Van Dorn, Ren Casey, David Coyne, Scott McCormick, James Konacek, Elizabeth Jernigan, and Mort Shelby. Additional red shirts by The Dead Giveaways. Directed and adapted by Johann Detweiler. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers, James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Temeskin Wubna. If you enjoyed The Survivalist, be sure to look for E.E. Knight's Vampire Earth and James Axler's Deathlands. Available at Road Stops Everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our Action Pump titles, as well as free downloadable extras, forums, and podcasts. Keep listening for a preview of another thriller in Graphic Audio.
Available now from Graphic Audio.
Graphic Audio presents E.E. Knight's Vampire Earth.
Hey there, fella. Don't shoot.
Step out of there and I won't. I don't want to hurt you. I just need the truck.
Mister, you got it backwards. We've been looking for you.
What we would that be?
Don't have time to go into it, mister. I know one of you's named David. You're three of those werewolf fellas from down south, right? You went to take a look at Blue Mounds? The vampire's goons spotted you, and now there's a big net out trying to snare you. I've been crawling up and down this road for the last hour looking for your tracks.
We've heard about you. Werewolves. Always coming in the dark, just like the Reapers. Don't you guys go into Kansas and Oklahoma and kill all the people there so the Kurians have nothing to feed on?
No. Nothing. Quite the opposite. Just this spring, my company brought over 100 people out of the Lost Lands. That's what we call places like this.
Lost Lands. I'll buy that. We're lost, all right. How would you like to spend your life knowing it's going to end with you being eaten? I developed a lot of sympathy for our cows. David, do I have to spell it out for you? Let's make love. I need you to do this for me.
Molly, I mean, we've never even kissed. This is kind of...
sudden? Well, yes, I suppose you're right. I'm going to be with this guy. And the thing that bothers me the most about it is that he'd be my first time. Not a memory I want to have for the rest of my life. I know you. I like you a lot. And I think you like me. You're an officer. A gentleman, too. Otherwise, you'd already be on top of me.
It's not like the thought hasn't crossed my mind, Molly.
Just go slow. Okay, David?
Gonzo, I'm gonna have to give you a lot of responsibility. Maybe it'll take your mind off the pain in your arm. I want to get the Carlsons and the Breitlings out of Wisconsin, all the way to Ozark Free Territory.
We can do it.
Maybe we could. But Gonzo, it's not gonna be a we. It's gonna be a you. I'm going after Molly.
Hey, friend. She's probably dead already.
I've had too many people I care about die. Not this one. Not this girl. Your time is up. In a few seconds, your master is gonna have one less drone. You know me, creature.
I know your kind, boy. Weak and easily emptied. I feast on your fathers at will, as I shall consume you.
Not my father. My name is David Valentine, son of Lee Valentine. Have you met my kind, creature?
The Vampire Earth Saga. Way of the Wolf, Part 2.
Available now in graphic audio.
I am Sakage, a lord of shadows. I claim the shadows that the shadow may not. I am the strong arm of deliverance. I am Shadow Strider. All the pieces will be put into play. I am the scales of justice. I am he who guards unseen. I am Shadow Slayer. I am nameless. A new darkness will rise. My way is hard, but I serve unbroken. I will do justice and love mercy. The final battle will threaten all the world. Until the king returns, I shall not lay my burden down. And only Kyler can stand in the way of the Krull.
There's no way to win except to raise these monsters. It will be an orgy of death.
Then let us raise monsters.
The end is nigh. Find out where all the pieces fall in Beyond the Shadows, Parts 1 and 2. Available in graphic audio.
If you can't find that graphic audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220. Or www.graphicaudio.net. And if you're looking for a great way to try out a different graphic audio series, check out our convenient and easy-to-store long-haul box sets, which contain up to 5 books of a series. Available only at www.graphicaudio.net. Be sure to sign up for our monthly newsletter or follow us on Twitter.